for tuning in to Aspen Public Radio as we bring you live broadcast throughout Spotlight Health Conference and the Aspen Ideas Festival. We're standing by for a talk set to begin at the Dorr Hoser Room on the campus, titled Beyond Opioids, Shining Light on Less Visible Prescription Drug Epidemics. That talk should start in just a moment. We go now to Beyond Opioids, Shining Light on Less Visible Prescription Drug Epidemics. This is Aspen Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
I'm the executive editor of healthcare at Politico, and with me we have Dr. Nora Volko, who is the director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse at NIH. You all know we have an opioid epidemic in this country. It's getting a lot of attention. What's not getting attention, and what we'll be talking about now, is that we have way more than an opioid epidemic. We have a multifaceted, all mushing into each other, I think that's the clinical term you'd use, right? Drug epidemic. The title of this session is The Other Prescription Drug Abuse, and we are going to talk about that, but we're also going to broaden it in our preliminary conversation. Meth is also, there's another wave of meth abuse in this country. There's another wave of cocaine abuse in this country. Fatalities are up. Addiction is up. It's really complicated. The national conversation is certainly an acute conversation now. We're talking about it, but we're not talking about all of it. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Let's start with some of the prescription. Okay, this I had to write down because as a print journalist, I don't have to know how to pronounce benzodiazepines, right?
Benzodiazepines, yes. You did it very well.
Right, I have spell check when it works. And those are the tranquilizers, the anti-anxiety drugs, the sleeping pills. They're legal. What's the problem?
Well, the issue is that overall there are classes of medications that we use to treat patients that have the potential of being addictive. And benzodiazepines is one of them. Opioid analgesics, like morphine, and another one. And the third classes is what we call the stimulants, which also can produce addiction. So all of these classes of drugs have a therapeutic benefit, but unfortunately, they all of them have rewarding effects, which means they make us feel good, and then they also change the brain in a way that they can ultimately produce addiction. And benzodiazepines is one of them.
And we tend to think these drugs are safe, right? Because they're prescribed widely, maybe too widely. We see them in our medicine cabinets. We see them in our friends' medicine cabinets. We sometimes see Ambien being handed out on airplanes and derailing cabinet secretary nominations. When something is legal and common, what's the barrier to making people understand that if it's not prescribed properly for you, it's abuse?
Well, I think that there are two things that go in there. One of them, first of all, the person that gets prescribed the medication that may not really understand that that medication, when not used specifically as indicated, may produce addiction, and actually, or even if followed as prescribed, can produce addiction if you have the vulnerability. But then there's the other side of the equation, which are those individuals that seek these medications because they know that can get you a high, but they believe they favor them over illicit drugs because they believe if they are given by physicians, they cannot be so harmful. So we have those two different group of individuals that can get exposed to benzodiazepines or other medications.
Let's talk about the stimulants, too. I mean, a lot of those are the ADHD drugs, which there's a whole separate panel we could have on whether they're being overprescribed. Some people clearly need them. Some people who get them may not. But they're really, and I don't know if it's just in high schools or college campuses, but they're all over the place. People get them from their friends. They're being sold. Is that abuse something we're just beginning to notice, or is it just suddenly, has it gotten worse in the last few years?
Oh, no. We've been very aware that stimulant medications actually can be abused, and they are abused, and they can produce severe addiction. Actually, there was an epidemic of stimulant addiction in the country in the 60s, because at that time, for all of you that may not know, stimulant medications are medications like methylphenidate or Ritalin, it goes by the name of Ritalin, or amphetamines, it goes by the name of Adderall, among other products. And these medications are most frequently prescribed for individuals that have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. In the past, it was believed that ADHD only basically affected children and adolescents, and it had to be initiated very early in childhood. And therefore, most of the prescriptions were given to children and adolescents. Recently, 5-6 years ago, the American Psychiatric Association recognized that you could initiate, actually, first of all, inattention, attention deficit disorder, can continue into adulthood, number one. Number two, you could initiate later on. And that has resulted in a massive increase in prescription of stimulant medications, continued to increase in adolescents, but increasing enormously in adults. And that has facilitated their diversion. All along, what's interesting about these stimulant medications is that people don't just abuse them or misuse them because they make you feel high. They are pharmacologically, actually, methylphenidate is pharmacologically similar to cocaine. And amphetamine is pharmacologically similar to amphetamine. But the route of administration and the doses that we use make them therapeutically safe when used properly. So individuals are using them, yes, because they make you feel high, but also because of the belief that they would make you smarter. And so one of the reasons why we're observing in the United States and other places in the world, Europe has been describing this, among college students, but also among professionals, that they use these medications to cram for an exam, or when you have to actually prepare a case, for example, lawyers, or they have to work very, very long hours, individuals may auto-medicate with these stimulant drugs with the idea that they will be able to memorize and to perform better. So they, in other words, this has led to the notion of misuse of these drugs as cognitive enhancer. So it's not just that you take them in order to feel high. People take them in order with a belief that it's going to improve their performance.
So what's wrong with that?
Well, it's wrong at many levels because, first of all, the problem is that these stimulant medications can be highly addictive. And we know that, and we've seen some reports of individuals that had ADHD becoming addicted to their medication. This, interestingly, is rare. And it's interesting, and it probably relates to a fact that drugs may be exactly the same drug we all take, but the way that our brain responds to it differs enormously because our chemistry is distinct. So the same medication may make a person feel very good versus another one may feel miserable. So in ADHD, there may be biochemical changes that in a strange way may make you less vulnerable to becoming addicted to your treatment. Or it may be that because you are being seen by a physician who follows exactly the doses that you need to take and that gives it in a way that is difficult to divert and abuse, why we are seeing relatively low levels of addiction in people
with
it.
Who are taking it therapeutically. Who genuinely needed it. Not the overprescribed.
Or the ones that are misusing it.
Right.
And definitely, and you're saying something that is very important, overprescribe or misprescribe. It's very easy to feign having ADHD. I can go to the doctor and I said, you know, I forgot to pick up my daughter yesterday. Oh, my God. And I forgot that I had a talk today at the Aspen Institute at 12 o'clock. My email will come in and says, where are you? But the reality, I'm just bringing it up, that the notion that any one of us can feign having inattention. So as a result of that, individuals are being diagnosed improperly with ADHD and giving these medications which will not be beneficial to them. And then they are at greater risk. And that's what you're saying. And definitively, if you are using these drugs to get high, then the risks are even higher because you have the expectation, which is another interesting phenomenon, the expectation that a medication is going to make you feel good is likely to make you feel better than if you have the expectation that that same medication is going to make you feel horrible. In other words, it's a similar akin to what we call placebo, where I say, this medication is great. It's going to get rid of your pain. I can do the same thing and say, this medication is going to make you feel high. You take the medication, and it's greater likelihood that you make high. So when people divert these medications to get high, they are at greater risk of addiction.
If I actually thought people would answer honestly, I would say, how many of you, and I'm not going to ask, how many of you have actually taken a drug that was not prescribed for you, a legal drug? A legal drug that was not prescribed. The answer would, what do you think? Because if I ask them, it's embarrassing. What percentage of the people in this room do you think have ever taken an Ambien, a Concerta, a Xanax that was not et cetera, that wasn't prescribed for them?
Yeah, no, and I
a lot of
and
people are willing to say it. You know, you got it from your sister-in-law's medicine cabinet. How common is it?
I think it is very common, and I know basically my friends, I mean, and they know that I work at NIDA and the Institute on Drug Abuse, and they come and says, Nora, you're going to take this trip to Europe. You should take this little Ambien. It will help you sleep. Many times that they told me, I says, no, guys, I don't want, because benzodiazepines can interfere with your memory. They can actually also are very addictive drugs. So I'm afraid of, since I studied this, I'm afraid of drugs. But many have brought me, if I weren't afraid of them, it's very tempting to fly to Europe and to be able to sleep all night long. And it's also the other one, and you're speaking about benzos, but it's the same sort of thing for college kids, and this has been written about. College kids are on tremendous amount of pressure to perform. They know that the environment is extraordinarily competitive. And when they see the other kids taking stimulants in order to be able to prepare for hours, they feel that they are at disadvantage if they don't take the stimulants, and that may lead them to take them. And I think the other aspect that we see also very frequently misused, whether it is prescribed for you that you've been given opioid medications for a surgery or a painful procedure, and basically you take them home and you says, you never know, you may have this horrible pain, and then they may come in handy. So the notion of people under a severe acute pain situation where they can take an opioid medication that was not prescribed for that particular event for in the past, that's also very, very common.
And it's not also that you're taking a drug that wasn't prescribed for you, but you're taking a drug that wasn't prescribed for you that could interact with something that was prescribed for you, but your doctor doesn't know that you're taking the one that you're not supposed to have. So, I mean, benzos are mixed with other drugs, legal and illegal.
No, absolutely correct. And this is one of the problems that we have in our country. As we're facing the opioid crisis, we're going to change something that has permeated our healthcare system, which is basically the fact that we are not trained as physicians on substance use disorder. We don't know how to screen a patient that's addicted. If they are addicted, we don't know what to do. So as a result of that, in the opioid crisis, we are seeing physicians not being able to help actually identify those patients that are greater risk. And they are also not trained to do exactly what they shouldn't be doing, which is, if I'm going to prescribe a benzodiazepine medication, I better be certain that that patient doesn't have a vulnerability for addiction. I better be certain that that patient is not an alcoholic, and or has a family history of alcoholism. And by the way, I better be certain that another doctor did not prescribe a pain opioid analgesic for the medical condition they have. And as a result of that, for example, right now we know that at least 15% of the opioid fatalities in our country are from individuals that mixed opioids with benzodiazepines. Another 15% are individuals that mix benzodiazepines with alcohol. We don't know if they did it on purpose, because people like to combine drugs when they are wanting to get high. But we do know that a significant number did not know about it. And I've encountered patients that told me, is benzodiazepine an addictive drug? I didn't even know about it. I have a history of alcoholism, and I've seen some instances where that resulted in the death of the person. So it's a very serious issue that we have, the improper training and education of physicians that then cannot properly guide their patients.
Because we know that heroin's not good for you, but we tend to think that something legal and widely prescribed is not that big a risk. People don't taking a drug that wasn't prescribed for you as a legal drug is seen as
Well, I think that in a way, that's the way that we were looking a lot at the opioids. If you look at the number of prescriptions that were given for Vicodin, they felt, it's okay, what's a big deal? And the reality, it's a big deal. And benzodiazepines are highly addictive, and they rapidly produce physical dependence. And what I can tell you, first of all, just to make a clarification, because we confuse all of these. Physical dependence refers to what happens when you get repeated certain drugs, like benzos, produce this very happy, alcohol, and also heroin and opiates. When you stop them, you have this horrible physical withdrawal. With benzos, it actually can kill you, because if you interrupt it immediately, you can have severe seizures. And that makes the actually stopping taking them so incredibly difficult. Opioids also produce physical withdrawal symptoms. Curiously, the symptoms from benzodiazepine withdrawal are even worse than those from opioids. And this is something that doctors don't even tell their patients. A patient comes in and says, I cannot sleep. And so it's very easy and immediate reinforcement for the patient as a doctor. Take this and you're going to sleep. The patient is going to sleep very well a couple of days, 1 week, and then they'll need higher and higher and higher doses, and they start to become physically dependent. And if they are vulnerable, they, on top of that, they become addicted.
A lot of there's a long, long list of problems with access to mental health care in this country. A lot of psychiatrists don't take insurance. People can't afford it. Primary care doctors, in many cases, because it's needed, are prescribing a lot more psychiatric, psychotropic drugs. What has to be done as they're being trained to prescribe them or being told to prescribe them? What do we have to bake into their training or their CME to understand that these things that they're handing out pretty liberally, what danger signs, what fuller pictures do they need to have, and what are the really potentially fatal red flags? I mean, do the primary care physicians who are giving out the sleeping pills aware of everything you're saying?
No, they are not. And one of the most frustrating things that I've had since I've been director of NIDA for 15 years is that we have not been able to get most of the medical schools to give a curriculum on training medical students on how to screen and understand the effects of drugs and the process of addiction. So they don't know. They are not trained properly. So what you're saying, what is it that we have to do is to ensure that there are questions that relate to substance use disorder and to drugs that can produce addiction in the medical exams, and also on CME. And some schools have started to become more proactive, but the question that we have got overall is, it's sufficient, it's covered. It's not covered. Most medical students do not come out with an understanding of how to screen and treat substance use disorders. So this is one of the low-hanging fruits that has been identified by the HHS as one of the top priorities. We need to educate the healthcare providers, and that includes not just physicians, primary carers, or even specialists. Psychiatrists. I'm a psychiatrist. Many of them actually don't know how to properly treat their patients. So this is an aspect. Nurses should be trained, pharmacists should be trained, dentists should be trained so that they can help identify and do practices that are adequate.
I want to talk a little bit about the rising use of cocaine, the fatalities we're seeing. Meth is also, there's another surge. I want to talk about sort of the breadth of the problem, and then I want to talk about some of the solutions we're beginning to come up with or attempt on opioids. Are they solutions that will help us address all these other problems, or is the attention and legislation and money going so much toward opioid that these other problems are getting neglected? So let's just start with these. I mean, what's going on with cocaine? And then cocaine and fentanyl.
Well, unfortunately, the latest data on 2016 by CDC shows that the overdose fatalities from cocaine have risen sharply, and actually over the past 2 or 3 years. We knew because the DEA has been reporting this to us that the amount of cocaine coming to the country has more than doubled. But what we didn't expect is this very fast rise of fatalities. Why not? Well, cocaine is toxic and it can kill you. It produces cardiac arrhythmias. But what does not make complete sense in my brain is that we know that the entry of cocaine has been going up over the past, I would say, 8 years, and yet the fatalities are rising in the past 3 years in parallel to the fatalities of fentanyl. So what many are hypothesizing is happening is that now drugs are being mixed with one another and that cocaine is being laced with fentanyl, which is accounting for the very, very fast rise in overdoses and the fatalities that we are observing. So the cocaine problem is here to, we are going to have to deal with it at the cocaine addiction, but the increase in the extremely high rate of mortality that we're seeing is likely to reflect that combination of drugs, and we're also seeing it not just combination of cocaine with fentanyl. It's been reported combination of marijuana with fentanyl, which then makes it lethal. Combination of methamphetamine with fentanyl. Methamphetamine is a highly toxic drug, so you just take it to another level. So we have to recognize that these synthetic drugs are so powerful that the drug dealers are actually probably combining them to be able to dilute a product and therefore still sell it as something that is very powerful. But even more of concern is that a product like marijuana, which is an addictive drug, but certainly is not as addictive as something like cocaine or heroin, but making that product all of a sudden so much more addictive if you lace it with fentanyl.
Because one of the questions I asked when we were talking before the session is, fentanyl is so lethal, I was saying, well, aren't the drug dealers killing their market? And you gave me a very scary response.
And the answer is yes, they are killing their market. And I think that, and there are different levels,
but
right?
They're creating a new market, right?
They are actually creating a new market, but they are, at the same time, where I was commenting a story, because I was in West Virginia, in Huntington, West Virginia, 2 months ago, and it's one of the most affected areas of the epidemic. And so we're trying to figure out what are the resources that we can use to try to expand treatment, because we can treat people that are addicted to opioids, but we are not doing it. And I found out by meeting with people in the community that actually the dealers there were starting to give free doses of fentanyl. And this is the way that you get new people addicted to the drug. So there is very aggressive campaign to ensure, first of all, to distribute fentanyl all over the country. It's all over the country. But also to make people addicted to it. And we see, and again, I go all over the country, but for example, I was meeting in one of these treatment programs that people go, it was a treatment program with a syringe exchange. So I was meeting with the people that went there for syringes. And there were the older heroin abusers that were telling me that they are afraid of the products they are buying because they know that they have fentanyl and they are afraid of overdoses. And then there's the other one, the younger ones that are seeking explicitly fentanyl because they are so tolerant that they need the extra strength of those drugs. So you have those that seek it out and those that are actually afraid that they may end up overdosing because the products that are being sold contain it.
How many of you know somebody, not necessarily a family member or a close friend, but how many of you know somebody who's died of a drug overdose in the last 2 years?
Me.
Yeah. I know an NIH scientist whose son died, yeah. It is not a class or regional, it is everywhere now.
Someone in my faculty who works with medications for opioids, his child died, yes.
Yes.
It's all over the place.
Right. You also told me something interesting about a year ago we started to hear about carfentanyl, I think, am I pronouncing that right? Which is, what did you say, 50 times, 500 times more, so it's like
heroin.
A couple of grains of sand, the equivalent of a few grains of it would kill you, right? It's a teeny, teeny amount.
One grain will kill
okay.
you.
So we were hearing that this was coming in, and then we're not hearing as much about it. Why, what is that?
I think that carfentanyl, which is, fentanyl is more or less 50 times more potent than heroin, which is incredibly potent. And carfentanil is 500 times more potent. So that gets you an idea how dangerous this drug is. And there's been reports, clearly, of overdoses with carfentanil, but they are limited and restricted. and they tend to come up in clusters in this area in the United States or there. And I think they die out exactly for what they, by what you were saying, because it is so, so little that those in, if, when everybody dies, and actually the dealers themselves are at high risk of overdosing themselves, because just the dermatological contact with these drugs or the inhalation of the product can lead you to an overdose, that has restricted. It's like a virus that is so virulent and lethal that it kills everybody, so there's nobody else to infect. The same thing happens with carfentanil. So I actually think that the reason why the dealers are being scared themselves of carfentanil is they recognize how lethal it is, and they are also afraid for themselves. Because they, how do you dose something that it has to be actually the size of a grain of salt, and you have to actually measure it, because if the grain of salt is slightly bigger, you will kill yourself. I mean, it is, in, they don't have the chemical capabilities to do that level of dosing. They mix this and that. And so I think that that's why carfentanil has fortunately not expanded like what we've seen with the other fentanyl analog.
But the fentanyl is all over the place, and it's all now in... We were hearing about it mixed in with heroin, but now you're seeing it with other drugs.
We are seeing it with all other drugs. Are basically, they are using it to lace it. And massive amounts of fentanyl are coming into the country. It's very, very scary. And it just highlights us also, I mean, in terms of what are the solutions, because you were asking me, what is it that we can do? I think that there are multiple things. It's not one thing that is going to solve the opioid crisis. But we also have to realize that we need to work together to ensure, number one, that we prevent people from getting exposed to drugs, that we prevent patients from getting exposed to drugs that can make them addicted unless they actually need them, and there's no many other alternatives, and we monitor them properly. And educate the public, educate all of us. I mean, what is it that we, each one of us, can do to actually help this crisis? It's a crisis that we have not been able to contain, and there's been massive engagement and investment from, I come from the government, from the multiple agencies that I am part of, which is HHS, to work together to facilitate evidence-based treatment, to expand medication-assisted treatment, to develop NARCANs that any one of us can apply even without a healthcare experience. To develop programs that can help people in rural communities get the treatment that they need. And yet, despite all of these, we have not been able to decrease the number of mortality, which goes up and up and up every year. 22% from 2015 to 2016, which was the last numbers that we had from CDC. So we, as each of us, as a citizen, has an opportunity to engage so that we can control the crisis, while not forgetting, which is what you are saying right now, let's not forget that if we were to address the opioid crisis, we cannot keep our eyes from cocaine because it's shooting up, or methamphetamine, or the new synthetic drugs that are going to come into the future. We have to tackle the problem from the inception, prevention. Prevention for people experimenting with drugs and awareness about the consequences of those drugs. So prevention, how do you prevent drug experimentation and misuse?
One of the things we have seen with the opioid crisis, and we haven't seen it 100%, and we haven't seen it uniformly everywhere, but you're a scientist, and you've been studying actually the effect of drugs on our brains, on the cells in our heads. And you understand that it's a... Some people are we're all wired differently. We have different vulnerabilities. We don't totally understand why someone could take opioids in a mild dose for a physical cause for years and not really develop a, you know, they take it now and then and don't get addicted, and someone else gets addicted in 3 days. You've known it's our biology, not our morality. You've known it's a disease, not a crime. That national dialogue has begun. You hear people talking about treatment, you hear people talking about, you know, substance abuse disorder, not, you know, throw everybody in jail. Where are we in that, which is something I assume you're happy to hear and see. How far along are we in understanding this is a public health, not, I mean, you want the bad guys in jail, right? You want the guys from China mailing the fentanyl here. You want
Stop.
Them in jail, right?
Yes.
But the people dealing with addiction, including the small-time dealers, Are we are we giving lip service to that? Oh, yeah, it's a disease. Or are we hitting that tipping point of understanding it's a disease? And is it only for opioids? Are we still thinking opioids is a disease, but cocaine is a moral failing?
We are seeing the stigma as it relates to addiction as a disease start to abate somehow, because people, and you all raised your hands, and as we know, as we can identify with someone that they overdose, we come to realize that it's not the other. And I think that the moment that we feel that it's someone like us, we can feel empathy. And I think that the suffering brought up by this crisis has made people realize that what we were doing in the past has not worked. We cannot afford to continue doing what we've done, which has been criminalizing the person that's addicted. In turn, the data is also showing that the best approach that you can do when someone is addicted is to treat them rather than imprison them. If you imprison them, you're making the problem worse. If you treat them, you can actually achieve recovery, and it's also the most cost-effective. And because the tragedy is so large, this has forced people to change their mentality. So I've seen individuals who were very much against, for example, practices of giving medication to individuals with opioid addiction, realizing that it significantly improved the outcomes of the person. So it's changing their prejudices. So it's not that we just stigmatize addiction. We also stigmatize the medications that we use to treat drug addiction. I mean, it's very common to hear, and I hear it, I would say, once or twice a week, oh, you're just changing one drug for the other. And this is really a lack of understanding about what these medications do. And it's interesting because it's not something that we apply for any other disorder. And you're speaking about this. If we really recognize addiction as a disease, then we shouldn't be questioning the need and the value of medications and the importance of treatment to manage it. And we still have a lot to go to do. And so one of the big aspects of what we need to do as we implement these evidence-based interventions is change the culture so that we can get treatment programs, provide evidence-based treatment, not just whatever is being sold as treatment. There's no quality. We don't demand quality for treatment of addiction, which is really a tragedy because when you see, and I hear the stories, I hear them, my parents coming to us and says, we mortgage our house to send our child to treatment. The treatment was there 1 month. They get released as if they were cured. And then they are released and they overdose and die. I heard this too many times. And again, it highlights the need and the demand. We should be demanding quality care treatment for people with addiction, just like we do it for any other medical condition.
In that conversation that's shifting toward more of a public health understanding, and we should say that the current Secretary of HHS is talking about medication-assisted treatment. Secretary Price was much more skeptical of it. Secretary Azar has been, you're probably happy to hear, when the words medication-assisted treatment come out of his mouth. Are we talking about it? I mean, there have been huge attention paid to the racial disparities in sentencing for different kinds of drugs. Are we talking about addiction is a disease if you live in a nice zip code and addiction is a crime if you live in an inner city?
You're making me smile because we do treat, the disparities on healthcare and outcomes are everywhere, and it's not just for addiction, it's for any of the conditions that we see. And for example, when you look at the epidemiology and how the whole crisis started, you started to find out that it was predominantly affecting white Americans, whereas African Americans or Hispanics were not. And the reason why they were not is if you're African American or Hispanic like me, you are actually less likely to be given a prescription opioid for your pain, which is basically, in a way, a prejudiced reaction of the physician. But in this case, it had a positive outcome. We do know, and this has generated an enormous amount of contention, that we over-incarcerate certain minority groups, in particular African Americans, were massively, many of them, incarcerated because of cocaine. And that was, again, brought up, at what point most of the heroin was in urban sites and African Americans. And now that it's migrated into Caucasians and whites, there have been many that have questioned whether the attention results from the fact that we're now dealing with a non-minority group. I don't know to what extent there is truth in that or not. What I do know is that right now, the opioid crisis is not distinguishing whites as it was doing it in the past. It's affecting, we're starting to see the mortality among African Americans going up. We're starting to see mortality, very high rates of mortality among American Indians. So it's actually everywhere.
Right. Questions from the audience now. We've got, start with this one here. We need a mic behind you. Please identify yourself and keep it a question.
Yes, okay. Esther Dyson, way to Wellville. I'd love to go back to this issue of vulnerability, how much it's due to something, you know, genetic or epigenetic from when you were born, and how much to, there's a huge correlation between adverse childhood experiences and addiction rates and a whole lot of other things. Understanding that science would be tremendously useful. And the question is, where are we on that understanding?
No, I agree completely. And we do know that addiction has a very strong genetic component. But we also know that adverse social environment increases the risk of you becoming addicted. But we also have heard from parents that tell you, we provided all of the love, all of the choices that our child, all of the support, and yet he became addicted and then overdosed. And I mean, a close colleague of mine who's a fantastic neuroscientist, whose son overdosed from an opioid 1 year after being given it for a medication. Another one who's an expert on addiction, whose son also died, or in this case, of an overdose from alcoholism. So what we know is that the genetic will determine, but there are different levels of vulnerability. If you don't have any genetics, you may be in an extremely adverse environment and still become addicted. And that's where the interplay is. On the other hand, if you have, as I mentioned in this case, the great genetic, the genetics for vulnerability for addiction, even in an environment that's protective, you will become addicted. So in between, what we now know from the science is that the genetic vulnerability in most instances reflect the way that genetic imprint, what the gene that may be engaging in that vulnerability, and it's now known it's multiple genes, the way that they impact that vulnerability is by affecting the way that you respond to the environment. So if I have, for example, a gene that makes me more vulnerable to a stressful environment, that makes me more vulnerable to addiction. And so what researchers are now trying to understand is bring together that element of genetics and environment, because that's ultimately what disease is about, and it's not different from anything else. Take, for example, lung cancer. There are people that have smoked all their life and never developed lung cancer, and yet there are others that may smoke very little or none. So understanding how drugs actually are influencing the expression, drugs actually influence expression of genes, and then how those expression of genes ultimately lead to the changes in the brain that produce addiction. That's one of the most fascinating areas of research.
Question is sort of, when will we know?
Well, the brain is extraordinarily complex, and we were discussing also how the excitement about genetics that they is going to be giving us answers right away. Genetics is giving us answers not precisely right away, so I cannot determine with a gene test what your risks are for addiction. I can do it by doing a clinical examination, get you a sense about your addictiveness. Nothing is perfect. But the human brain is extraordinarily complex and extraordinarily diverse. And so are our genetics. So we will not get simple answers. But what we will learn to know is exactly how genes are affecting your brain structure, how they are affecting the development of your brain. And we're doing right now, so your question, since you want timelines, we started a project 2 years ago in which we are monitoring, we will be monitoring 10,000 children as they transition into adulthood, genetics, brain imaging, phenotypic characterization of environment, to understand exactly what you're saying. We realize that it's actually, we will not have all of the answer, but it will give us clue that then we can pursue to try to come and nail specifically what genes may make you more vulnerable and why are they making you more vulnerable.
Can we move to get somebody else to have a question? Right. Right here.
Hi, Dr. Volkow. I'm Susan from Vice, and addiction is a disease, not a crime, but until the DEA and DOJ come around on that idea, how can NIDA help expand access to treatment in prison so that people aren't leaving and overdosing, like you mentioned?
You're making me smile because that's one of our top key priorities, as is in terms of the opioid crisis, and we want to expand medication and treatment. We need to get the criminal justice system involved, and such that individuals can receive treatment in prison, because if they don't receive treatment in prison, their likelihood of dying within the first 2 weeks is 13-fold higher than that of the general population, 13-fold higher. And if you treat them, you prevent that.
That's partly because they've detoxed in the hardest possible way, and they go and think they can tolerate this, but they're... That
no
kills
longer
them,
tolerant.
Right.
They are so no longer tolerant.
They overdose in those first 2 weeks, right?
They still have the addiction. Because what people say is, okay, we remove them in prison. They've been there 2 years. They are treated. No, they are not treated. They don't have tolerance. But the changes in the brain that create this memory that triggers this intense desire for the drug, and I'm just going to tell you a metaphor. It's akin to what, if you hadn't been eaten like 4 or 5 days, nothing, or 6 days, that akin to that hunger that motivates and drives your actions. It will change the way your brain works because you need to find food if you want to survive. And addiction produces that artificial sense of a state of deprivation where if you do not get the drug, you will not make it. And that's why it's so extraordinarily powerful. So yes, they are addicted. They have this intense craving and they die. So we are creating actually a network of criminal justice systems, partnering with academics to start to develop models that could be acceptable by the justice settings. And again, we've done some of that research, but we want to expand it because a significant portion of individuals with an opioid use disorder do enter into the justice setting, and it's a great place to initiate treatment. I'm not for jailing someone on prison or jail, but that's out of my control. For whatever reason they end up there, we need to provide treatment. Otherwise, they may die, and also, otherwise, they for certain be reincarcerated.
Question right here.
Hi, thank you, Dr. Volkow and Joanne. And thank you, Joanne, for raising the question about the disparities around race and socioeconomics as well. My question is about harm reduction techniques. Why do you think that, you know, you mentioned over the past, of course, this opioid crisis, we're still at a loss, even though this crisis is 50 years long, we're still at a loss for what to do, how to treat it, how to reduce the deaths. But as you know better than I, as a physician, there are evidence-based harm reduction techniques in Brazil, in Canada, in the Czech Republic, in Portugal, around syringe exchange programs, around naloxone distribution, around fentanyl testing strips. Why don't you think nationally here in the States, more communities are embracing SEPs or naloxone distribution or fentanyl testing strips for nothing no other reason to keep people alive so that we can treat them?
Yeah, you can't get them into rehab once
exactly.
They're dead.
Yeah, no, and I think that this argument is very clear, and I actually, because there have been criticism about expanding naloxone, my perspective is we want to make naloxone available as widely as possible so that we can save people. And he says, well, we know that once you overdose, your risk of overdosing, again, if you don't get treatment, is extremely high. So you are just rotating, and some have even said we shouldn't reverse overdoses if they occur more than 2 or 3 times. Because they are just promoting their drug use. It's basically, well, if you don't do that, they are dead. They are not going to overdose again. For certain, they are dead. So I think that the naloxone distribution program probably is one of the ones that has been now embraced by most of the states. They are critics of it. But the reason why it has been the most successful is if you look at the numbers, you can see how many people are being saved from basically naloxone reversals. Other programs have been much harder to actually implement. Syringe exchange programs. We knew now for close to 20 years that syringe exchange programs were very effective in preventing HIV. We didn't need to do more studies. And yet many states did not implement them. And this reflects the stigma that we have towards addiction and the way that we generate policies towards it. Of course, it would be ideal. I would be the first one to love it if no one was addicted. But that's not a reality. So if we cannot treat someone to be in recovery, what can we do to improve their quality of life and to prevent them from dying? And there is clearly data that some of these programs can significantly improve, number one, the likelihood that the person will not get hepatitis C or HIV or endocarditis. But also, these programs have been shown to improve the likelihood that someone gets engaged with treatment. But I think that as more and more fatalities are hitting the communities, this is leading people to realize that they have to change their practices, even with the stigma that they have. And we saw that with Indiana, right, with Scott County, where syringe exchange programs were not acceptable. But when they had the outburst of HIV, they had no choice because they knew that this was the solution. And unfortunately, we have had to get to this very tragic situation to start to change some of these practices.
There are a lot of new grant programs for states to start doing community-based, an assortment of outreach and some of the things he's discussing. It's like $6 billion, and some of it's appropriate, some of it's authorized. We won't try to figure that out here. But there's a lot of money coming into opioids. Is it coming into opioids in such a restrictive way that, okay, we can treat people who are taking opioids, or is it opening the door? In other words, is it opening the door to treating drug addiction, or are we putting so many of our resources into the opioids? Maybe we'll have a needle exchange for opioids, but we're doing nothing about the benzo. I mean, in other words, is it a net gain, or are we just shuffling things around? And then we have to wrap up.
Well, some of this money is basically earmarked for the opioid crisis, and so we are prioritizing because of the tragedy. However, regardless of the implementation, these same practices will be helping other substance use disorders. But some of them will be lacking. And for example, we have no medications to treat cocaine addiction, to treat marijuana addiction, methamphetamine addiction. And for now, we are going to have to incentivize and perhaps put to a little bit of a back burner. We're not going to stop it. Treatment programs for these other addictions. So just because of the urgency of what we are living, time is against us. I mean, every 12 minutes someone is dying. So there is that element of urgency.
Okay, well, that's a sort of sober note to end on. Every 12 minutes someone is dying. But maybe that is the note we should, in fact, take with us as we leave here and go home.
Well, I think that the other aspect of it that I think it is important is, as bad as the opioid crisis looks, the reality is we know what interventions we can do that would actually be able to control it and reverse it. We know it. I mean, we expand medication, we give access to naloxone, we provide treatment programs that support the individual that's addicted, we do universal prevention. We train physicians know how to properly prescribe opioids. We know there are multiple tasks, but we don't know how to deal with Alzheimer's disease. So I think that the notion is we have to recognize where we are. What we need is the will and the effort to put the resources and to integrate our capacity and what each one of us can do to bring the solution. So we have medications, they work, but we're not taking advantage of them. So how do we change that? And I guess that's why. My position is we cannot afford to fail. We have to address and solve the opioid crisis. And we will. The issue is how long will it take? And that's where that notion, it will be very much dependent, of course, on the system itself, the resources that are brought into play, and our ability to work and coordinate our efforts.
Okay. And on that note, our time is out. Thank you so much.
This is Aspen Public Radio. You've been listening to a live broadcast from the Spotlight Health Conference at the Aspen Institute, Beyond Opioids, Shining Light on Less Visible Prescription Drug Epidemics. You can find this discussion and others in full later today on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. You can also look there for the full live broadcast schedule. Support comes from the Aspen Ideas Festival from Obermeyer. Support for the live broadcast of the Aspen Ideas Festival comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Council, an independent investment advisor committed to helping clients navigate life's financial decisions. Learn more about the firm's team and approach at obermeyerwood.com. Another live broadcast coming up in about 10 minutes. Thanks for tuning in to Aspen Public Radio.